Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm. I will be your host. I'm once again joined with my good friend, Doug Hagren. Hey, Doug.
Good morning, Kirk. And I'm alive here until... just kidding. You never know these days. I keep hearing these stories of everybody now just drops dead.
One thing that's been interesting to me, I'll just point it out, is totally correlation, not causation. But it always makes me wonder, when you see an enormous amount of celebrities, broadcasters, public figures that just kind of get knocked off their pedestal. It's fine if it's one, like, you know, Tucker Carlson's the big one. He got knocked off his pedestal. He's off the air, although I think he might be back on now. I don't know.
He had more people following him on his first stream on Twitter than ever watched him on terrestrial television. So he's knocked off, but with the new monetization of Twitter, I think he's going to land on his feet pretty well.
And the reason I bring it up is not really Tucker per se, but we had Tucker and then you had Don Lemon and you had a bunch of other people that just kind of got knocked off their post all at the same time, which leads me to wonder, like, what's going on? Are all of these stations cleaning house and getting rid of their baggage, if you will, of all the stuff that's happened in the last 10 years where they're like, hey, we don't want somebody who has this opinion or that opinion. They're just like, we're going to clean the slate and start fresh. I don't know. I just find it interesting. And I bring this up not to talk about politics, but because it's an example everybody understands. Think about it this way. Like, anytime you're analyzing a situation, you should always look at it and say, huh, that's interesting. Anytime you catch yourself saying, huh, that's interesting, that should give you pause and should actually cause you to go dig a little deeper. Because that's your brain saying there's something here, can't put words to it, but there's definitely something here and I should look into it. So when you're investing, you should do the same. So when you're looking at a portfolio, and I'll give you an example, I had this conversation actually with a client last night and he made this comment actually about, about me talking about him in the air. So this is a perfect opportunity to talk about him in the air. So you know who you are. So anyway, we were talking about the idea of, oh, well, what about these high dividends? You know, why shouldn't I invest in a high dividend stock? And I said, well, that's a great question. Well, if dividend stocks are yielding 4% on average, and there's these ETFs that are yielding 7, 8, 9%, it's got to make you stop and wonder, huh, that's interesting. I wonder why they're doing so much better. Now, think about it from this perspective. We can get into the details in a minute. I can bring up one and talk about it. But here's the thing. So the market is more or less an equilibrium setting machine. So buyers and sellers come to a point. You could argue whether the price is right. It's kind of irrelevant. But the buyers and sellers come to a point and they come to a price. And that price is reflected on the charts that we show on the show and that you see on your own screens. Now, what that means is all the given information at that second is showing you this is the correct price. Because if it wasn't the correct price, somebody would bid it up until it hit the correct price. So Warren Buffett, he's been buying Oxy Petroleum and he's been buying shares when they go below a certain point. And he's even said, hey, below a certain point, I'm going to buy. And everyone knows below a certain point, he's going to buy more. He's got a thesis. He doesn't necessarily share it, but he's got a thesis. And there are a lot of investors that'll do this. They'll say, all right, here's my buying point. And actually, we'll bring up Warren Buffett again. This is something he has publicly said. His book value per share price of Berkshire Hathaway is a certain number. He believes if it's under a certain number, he's going to buy his own company shares back because it's a better deal than anything else he can see in the market. Now, I bring up this example because Warren Buffett is arguably one of the smarter, if not smartest, investors of our era, or at least in his style. I could argue there's other people who are smart too, but in his style, he's probably the best. And here's a guy who looks at the whole world and can invest anywhere. He can get sweetheart deals from governments. Here's a guy who's got, you know, a red line to any dictator or despot or president or whatever you want to call them that runs these companies or countries. And, you know, they'll take his call. Look at the financial crisis. He took calls from everybody. His phone was ringing off the hook from every company saying, hey, Warren, bail us out. He ended up bailing out Goldman Sachs, Bank of America. I think there were one or two others. But basically, the point was, is he had all the cash and people needed cash. So he bartered himself a really good deal.
Bailout. You mean like value purchase?
Correct. Yes.
It's a bailout. He just, generosity of his heart. He's such a giving soul.
Yeah, he was so giving. He got 20% plus all those things. So giving. But the point is now here's a guy who can invest in anything. And what he said is, I would rather buy my own company shares below a certain price because that's a better deal than I'm seeing on the market. Now, investors should take pause and say, that's interesting. this is the best deal that Mr. Value Investor himself is seeing on the market. What am I missing? Why am I investing in these other stocks when I can invest in this at a certain price? So my point is using him as a comparison, and so that every investor in the whole market is doing this themselves. They're looking at fixed income, they're looking at real estate, they're looking at stocks, they're looking at options, they're looking at futures, they're looking at all this stuff, and they're saying, this is my best opportunity set here. So that being said, when you see an outlier, let's say the market rate is 5% for bonds for a certain carve out, right? For maturity, for credit, whatever. Let's say 5% is the average for what everybody's getting in that. And then you see a 12%. Something's got to go in your head and not say, oh my God, I need that yesterday. What it really should say is, what am I missing? What's going on here? That's the question that should come through your mind. So anytime you see a, oh my God, this is the best deal I've ever seen, I need to put all my money in it, that's the wrong way to think about it. The right way to think about it is, what am I missing? Now, it could be that you have information that other people don't have. You have analysis that other people don't have. I'm not saying that you're always missing something. This is why value investors can do really well, is they identify situations that people have not seen. Now, there was a company many years ago, a biotech company that owned patents, and they basically changed the company at one point to a royalty company where they're just getting paid royalty payments from their drugs that they had sold to other companies. There were 4 employees. They're basically cashing checks. The dividend was 30%. Now, at 30%, it makes me wonder, yeah, I know I'm missing something, but there's got to be something in here worth looking at, because there's no good or bad investments, only good or bad prices. So in this certain circumstance, I talked to a lot of really smart people and they agreed, like, you wouldn't buy this forever, but you could buy this for 2 years and you could easily make 30%+. And we bought the stock and did really well. That's an outlier. That doesn't happen often. And I generally don't do that kind of stuff because there's a lot more risk there because there's more stuff you don't know. But it doesn't mean you can't find opportunities. But what it does mean is you should spend more time looking at what are the risks. So in the circumstance we talked about, he had pointed out this one situation, which was an outlier. Said, oh, here's this thing. It's getting a really high dividend yields. And I look at it, I'm like, all right, what's in there? Utilities, real estate, financials, energy. Those are the big players. Well, why do I want to own any of those in our current environment? Those are stocks I wouldn't want to own. Now, you might make an argument about financials are probably a good deal now because they're sold off, whatever. The point is you want to understand what's giving you that 7%. Energy stocks won't do well in a recession. If interest rates go higher, utilities, real estate, and financials probably won't do well. And if interest rates keep going higher, real estate's going to get creamed. So all 4 of those are really problem areas. And I'm not suggesting that you should sell all your stocks in those areas and go to cash. What I'm suggesting is you should understand the dynamics of how the market is going to interact with those. So if 60% of a dividend stock portfolio is made up of things that are going to not do well in a bad environment, then you probably should move on and do something else. Because the difference might be between 5 and 7%. Is that 2% worth the downside of 40, 50%? No, absolutely not. If I'm getting 5% on U.S. Treasuries and I get 7% on a dividend stock portfolio, which could decline significantly, I would take the 5% every day of the week. And it doesn't mean it's always the right choice, but in a comparison, if I'm comparing the two, U.S. Treasuries, which have virtually no risk, they obviously have risk, but there's virtually no risk. There's as little risk as you can find, versus a dividend stock, which is a stock which has risk, a dividend which in itself has risk, and all these other factors that come in. So there's variability and you're only getting 2% for that. To me, it's a no-brainer. I would not take that deal. I would take the 5%, close to guaranteed. I hate using the word guaranteed because you get in trouble, but close to guaranteed is as close as you can get in an investment. And it's a better deal. Now, if you're saying it's 5% and 14%, I'd say, all right, let's talk about that. What does that look like? What's the exchange? That might make more sense to do it. And there's obviously gray areas in between. But I wanted to start with that context because really, as we look at these different situations, we need to understand, what are we exchanging? We're exchanging risk for reward at many different levels. And if you don't understand the risk versus reward that you're exchanging one for the other, then you're probably going to not make as much money as you can, but probably more likely lose more money than you should, because you don't understand the trade-offs. You don't understand what's more important. And if this is 2009 in March and we're having this conversation, it's a very easy trade-off, because you might look at it and say, oh my God, there's so much risk out there. And I would say, how do you characterize risk? Yes, of course there's risk out there. That's why the prices are low. However, the prices being low reduce that risk. So the market has priced it accordingly to the risk that people are aware of, which in many ways is overpriced down, which is a good buying opportunity. So understanding the balance of risk reward is really important. So Doug, what are your thoughts on all this? I just kind of went on a rant, but I think it's an important context as we start our next segment.
I'm going to summarize all this up, Kirk, into an old saying, buy low, sell high.
Well, yeah, you could say that.
That's what you're talking about, right? You're talking about fundamentally what you just described as chasing returns. It's like I'm looking at where's a high dividend, where is it performing? And you just mentioned in summary in the piece you just said, look, you know, why would I buy that right now? It's already expensive. Energy, it's already expensive. Has it dipped back a little bit? Sure it has. Now, if you look fundamentally and historically, guess what happens? You're right, in a recession. People are like, well, I still got to drive. Yes, but recessions create a situation in which manufacturing will reduce its output so that it does not exacerbate what generally is already going to be an inventory problem. Now, we could argue whether or not we're going to have an inventory problem in the current markets because now this comes back to the issues with stagflation, right? We don't have the supply chain. We don't have the production to meet the demand that's been there, but they're trying to ramp this up. The same thing is happening in housing, which we will talk more about, is they're trying to ramp this up by producing more and more and more new homes. Well, if the demand falls off on this, then all of a sudden you run into a situation in which they're not going to need the materials. We're seeing this on housing. If you look at the data in lumber, lumber values are plummeting right now. It's telling you the outlook is there will not be a demand for the raw materials that go into housing. That's what people are predicting. If you look at energy, if we go into a situation where we have a sharp decline, a deflation in the demand of goods, most of the goods we make in the world are made of petroleum, right, Kirk? To some degree. Sadly speaking, even most of the food we eat is made with petroleum. So, you know, all of a sudden, they're going to stop producing that. That's going to have a profound impact on energy. Go back and look at any history. That's going to drop. You've talked about the dividends. I know there's a lot of people that brag about dividends. And we've talked about this before. If you don't understand where the dividends are coming from, I'm going way back here, Kirk. I think I brought this up a year ago. We talked about Pitney Bowes. Pitney Bowes was one of the darling dividend providers in the, I don't know if it was on NASDAQ. Anyway, it was an old school company. It was probably at one point, it was part of the Dow. The point is Pitney Bowes was producing something like a 15 to 20% dividend. Awesome. People are diving into it, looking for this incredible payout. And unfortunately, what dividend junkies are always looking for is they're always thinking, they're looking at dividends like it's interest. And if you look at interest, and this is one of the fundamental problems that people have with the half-truths of compounding. And I hear it all the time. Compound interest. If you just keep putting money in the market, compound interest is going to grow. This. That isn't compound interest. That's compound appreciation. And that doesn't flat out exist. You know that, Kirk. It doesn't exist. You can get a 5% return this year. You don't keep that 5% return if next year the market's down 10. Now, interest, compound interest is the only mathematical equation that works here because you have a flat, albeit the dollar does go up, does go down, but not relative to your own purchasing. In the United States, the dollar is what the dollar is. And you have the dollar and you get 5%. Next year, if I had $1,000 and I get 5%, I have $1,050. That's how it works. And the next year I compound again, it keeps going up. And so people look at dividends this way. They look, hey, I'm going to buy the stock and I get this dividend and I'm just going to keep going. It's going to keep going up. But dividend companies are often, their total return is a combination of the appreciation of their stock value and the dividend that they give. And as long as those two things are positive, wonderful. But you know, you're generally going to give up some price appreciation when you are looking at a dividend stock as opposed to a growth stock where it's all being reinvested in compounding. So when you start to compare the two things, you look at dividend stocks and wow, maybe the dividend stocks and the value stocks have underperformed what growth stocks have because of where the money wants to go and where people are viewing it. I'll go back to Pitney Bowes. So where was this dividend coming from? You peel back the covers or you don't know who's swimming naked until the tide rolls out, an old Buffett saying. Guess what? We don't use stamps anymore. Pitney Bowes is the stamp machine.
I use stamps.
You still use stamps? I understand.
I still use carrier pigeon too.
You know, that's okay. The ones that are still alive. So Pitney Bowes, I mean, so for a while there, they were still getting the rents of their postage machines and there was some carryover. But look, anybody looking around could have said, geez, you know what? Post office keeps jacking prices because they're trying to make up for a diminishing demand. Gosh, we've got stamps.com. We've got computers. We're sending more emails. Letters are going down. This just doesn't look right. But yet, Pitney Bowes stock was rocking and their 15% dividend was rocking. But the fundamentals, something didn't smell right. Well, we're not going to pull it up now, but look at their stock price over the last 15 years now. Awful. But their dividend stayed massive for a long time. What were they doing, Kirk? They were basically spitting out revenue in a dividend. They were using the dividend to entice you to continue to buy their stock, but it was a diminishing return because the company was hemorrhaging cash. You know, you have to really understand what you're looking at and what you're investing in, and you have to look at the fundamentals and what's going on around it. Does it look like the environment should be good for this type of a situation? If not, this is probably a time to change your thinking and move in a different direction. But unfortunately, that's not emotionally what a lot of investors will do. And that's why if you go out on FinTwit, for those older people out there, that means financial Twitter, you know, the people that are all giving, you know, lots and lots of questionable half-truth advice out there, they'll tell you, dividend this, or, you know, look at the data out there. The data is telling you this time it's different. Everything's great. But you look around, you start to sniff and go, something doesn't smell right. Probably something to heed. And remember, the first way to know there's an electrical fire is the smell.
I want to dig into some charts here. We want to dip into housing today. And then we went down the road of dividend stocks, which I think is really important because people are, once again, yield hunting and looking for opportunities. I'll bring up a stock as an example. You know, we don't like to talk about stocks because the regulators don't like that. But I'm going to give this an example because it's really just news and I'm not endorsing the stock whatsoever. But let's look at a stock, Icahn Enterprises, so IEP, and they are basically Carl Icahn's company and he uses it for basically his investing vehicle. And it has historically had a pretty high dividend yield. So the dividend yield, I think, was somewhere in the neighborhood of, was it 15%? I know it's more now, but it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 15%, some of thereabouts. And it was pretty flat, you know, fluctuated, but it was a pretty flat stock. So people bought it and they're like, oh, I can get my 15%, yada, yada, yada. Well, some news came out, I think it was like a week ago, where somebody, it was a short, a company that issues short reports. So basically they're trying to tank the stock. I don't know if it's valid or not, but every time you see those, it kind of makes you scratch your head. Like, what am I missing? Like we talked about earlier. So the short report comes out and it's like, you know, talks about all this bad stuff. Well, the stock goes from like 51 down to like 30, and now it's at like 33. Well, now the dividend yield is close to 25%. You might say, oh my God, I got to do that. It's 25%. Well, I guess it depends. Depends if the short report's right or wrong. I don't know. It's not a stock I'm following, not buying and selling it, and I'm just not participating. But I point it out because it's a good example of what we talked about with the dividend stocks. Because if you feel this company is a good company and that there's solid cash flows to support everything, all that, and it can support the dividend, now you got a pretty fat 25% yield year in, year out, assuming it stays the same. I'm not saying it stays the same. I'm making no assumptions whatsoever in the stock, but I point it out because it's a great example of one that's currently in the news that it, people are arguing whether it's a good deal or not, and you can make your own decisions. I'm not making a decision for you, but it's a good example because people have made assumptions about it, and those assumptions change. GE is another one. GE had a quote-unquote solid dividend as any company. It was, I guess, the last original Dow stock in 2008. They basically had to pull their dividend down to like one penny because the company was on the borderline of going out of business, as most companies were. So that was a AAA rated company. I think there were three in the world. They were one of them. And they went from AAA down to whatever they went to. And people argue whether they were even solvent. But that being said, that's in a case where people were counting on that dividend. It was a pretty good dividend. And then all of a sudden just went away. So leave it to a crisis to cause dividends to decline or go away, especially for companies that are stretching it. And this happens with dividend stocks a lot where they stretch it. So take any company you'd think of as solid, like McDonald's, Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola, whatever, like one of those companies, you know, consistent track record of decades of paying dividends, raising dividends, things you can count on. You know, retirees probably buy these things for the dividend because they can consistently count on it. All that's well and good as long as their business model stays with a narrow range of predictability. Now, if like GE, which did have a over two decades, had a really consistent model of producing solid numbers over and over and over again, people argued whether it was financial engineering, which in hindsight probably was, But regardless, people counted on that. They said GE is solid. You can count on their dividend until you couldn't. And then it just went away. So this happened with BP and the oil spill. They had a fat dividend. It was 7.5%. And all the pensioners in the UK counted on that dividend for their retirement. And it just disappeared because of the BP oil spill. And I don't know what it's at now, but basically you lost that cash flow. So just understand that dividend stocks can be a great thing, but they can also disappear. It depends on the company, depends on the portfolio. There are some companies you can say, hey, these are great, but you have to understand that they can go away if you choose wrong or if you don't actively manage it, meaning that GE may have been fine for a few decades, but at a certain point, you're like, yeah, I'm questioning whether this is viable. Let me move it to something else. So you always have to make those decisions and decide if you want to keep the stock. But it's important to just point out, because I think, as we all know, things change. If you're not changing with them, then that can cause problems.
I want to just add the one quick thing on that. Keep in mind, there's one company that just crossed over like 100 years old, but very few companies in the S&P 500, in the Dow, very few public companies ever make it past 50 years, which is kind of a scary thought. So, you know, what might be a darling today? I mean, look at what 3M's going through right now. 3M was untouchable for decades. They are now kind of in the same boat as GE's was going through. There's a lot of things going on, a lot of mix-ups, layoffs, their stock's been underperforming, their company's looking at dividing up. These are major shifts. Every great company is going to come to a point in which it may not be great anymore. And you've got to be doing your research as to whether or not the fundamentals have changed. And if it's still the same company that you've always believed in today.
Hey, Doug, did you hear? We're giving away free money. Well, I'll tell you about it in a bit. There's a saying in the mining community. Well, precious metals mining, that is. The saying is that if you want the best deals, you have to be in the room. Now, you're probably thinking, what does it mean to be in the room? Well, I'll tell you. Being in the room means that you're on the short list of people who get invited to be a part of the best deals. These are the deals that most investors will never have access to. You mean like IPOs? Nope. IPOs are chump change. Those are for retail investors, small potatoes. That's nothing compared to these deals. These deals would have you salivating to get access to them. Once you know they exist, you will never look at investing the same way again. I almost don't want to tell you they exist because it'll ruin your thinking of how the investing world really works. Now, you might be excited that these deals exist, but you only have access to the deals if you're an insider or in the room, as they call it. As loyal listeners of the show, I'm going to give you a chance to be in the room. Money Tree Investing Podcast has created the Insiders Club. This is a community of our show's members who are loyal listeners of the show and want to get more out of their investing experience. Being a part of the Insiders Club gives you insider status for upcoming events and private webinars, discounts, free stuff and books, and influence on the future direction of the show. This is an opportunity to join us as we expand our content and services. Oh, did I mention you're getting free money? Yes, in the next few weeks, I will be giving free money to members of the Insiders Club as my appreciation for listening to the show. There's no cost to join the Insiders Club. Just go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money. Do that today to join the community. That's moneytreepodcast.com/free money. I hope to see you in the room.
One other quick story, because you just mentioned something that's important. Diebold, depending on how you phrase it. That was back in 17, I think it was 2017, was the longest running dividend stock that had increased their dividends every year. And I think it was like 58 years, enormous track record of paying out dividends, increasing them every year, good times and bad. They had a great business model. And then they merged or got bought out with Nixdorf. So now they're Diebold Nixdorf. And basically the stock went sour and they end up killing the dividend altogether. So I don't follow the stock, but I remember the story and I remember it always being at the top. It was always ahead of some of those big stalwarts that we all know the names of. And it was like something like 58 years. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. 58 years. And then one bad merger, all went away. And now they don't even have a dividend. So I just point that out because it's important to understand that times change. And if you've owned a stock for 50 years, that doesn't mean you have to continue to own it. A lot of people don't want to sell because they don't want to pay taxes. But sometimes paying 20% taxes is much better than losing half your stuff. So always a tough decision to make because you don't know the future, but it is a decision you should consider. So let's dive in here to our charts. And I don't know if you want to start with us, Doug, but I'm going to start with the unemployment rate. This is the unemployment rate chart. You want to start, Doug, and I'll just kind of scroll through the slides, or you want me to do it?
Go ahead, scroll. You get, okay. You're in the control of it. I'll let you kind of drive one because the slides are all over the place for us. But okay. We got so much stuff in the past week that we've been kind of reading around. We've been grabbing them, and then we try to kind of talk and organize with it because this all plays in. And there's some other charts on here that are talking about kind of comparing what was the predecessor to 2008 versus what we're seeing and kind of what's going on right now. And here's the thing, the unemployment rate. We talked about the HOPE chart last time. And we talked about how employment is the last, typically the last shoe to fall. The unemployment rate is absolutely at a level of incredible lows, right? And you can take a look here. The Fed publishes this information. You can see where the unemployment rate spiked to, you know, 2020. Obviously, everybody's unemployed because things were closed down. It's now back to, if you look at the lowest level of unemployment, you know, how far does this chart go back, Kirk? I'm trying to look at
the late 40s, 1940s, late 40s.
1940s. So you've got some, you know, a little bit lower percentage of unemployment here at the early, like kind of total on the left end of the chart. Other than that, we are at a lower level of unemployment than we have seen in almost the entire history of this tracking. But here's the thing, look around you, talk to people. I'm starting to hear more and more talk about layoffs that are occurring in companies. They're starting to raise exactly what we talked about in the HOPE chart. And this is something we can go through some charts and talk about here, but this is where we have a real battle going on between the people that are looking at the history and saying, look, this time it's going to be exactly the same, and people looking at the history saying this time it's different. And if you look at some of the numbers that are out there in housing, we do have a lot of very different variables going on here. I mean, more than probably any time that we've seen in the history of housing, we have more houses out there that are paid off, that are sitting. We have lots of houses out there that, you know, are incredibly historic, probably never to be seen again. Knock on wood. I think I got some wood here. Mortgage rates. And it's putting people in a situation of like, all right, there's this view that we, you know, people are fully employed. Nobody owes money on their house. Although I would argue one of the things going into the statistic is they're saying, well, look at all the homes that are paid off. And then they say, but look at all the homes that have less than 50%, you know, have over 50% equity. Listen, to me, over 50% equity doesn't mean diddly. What do you mean by that? It means their home's paid off. They still got to pay next month. It doesn't matter if you have paid off the majority of your home. If you still have a payment due and you don't have the liquidity to the side because you went out and spent it, or you've been maybe making overpayments on your mortgage to try to pay it off and gotten rid of your liquidity and your security, because we have a greedy driven investment society. Everybody wants, and you see it all the time. I'll go back to FinTwit. It's all about getting more return. It's all about, if you do this, you pay someone to help you, you're going to lose return. If you have interest, you're going to lose return. If you have your money in cash, you're losing return. These are, I would argue, half truths to untruths. Okay, because it's about balance financially. Many people are not balanced. You may have equity, but what does equity mean? Equity means you have the ability to potentially get a bank to lend against your income, right, Kirk? Yeah. Against the value of your house. Well, congratulations. But what happens when that income's gone? What happens if we have the unemployment spike? And we talk about investing. You know, when you think about investing, Kirk, when's it generally a good time to invest? Well, generally a good time to invest is when a stock has hit lows. If, as long as the fundamentals look right, as long as it's a well-run company, let's say some ridiculous news comes out or we hear about Russia bombing Ukraine for the first time, what happened to the stock market? It took a little bit of a battle. That's probably a buying opportunity because these are great companies that just got some froth taken off of them. But generally speaking, when things are low, if long as everything looks right, it's time to buy or to bet it's going to go in the opposite direction. And when things are high, this is when it's time to bet in the opposite direction. Kirk, these unemployment figures are incredible, but a lot of it has been driven by the bullwhip effect. Talked about that before, right? We basically went from the bullwhip effect of laying everybody off for COVID to all of a sudden the entire economy coming back to life like a spark and nobody being able to find the labor that they need to fill these roles. I mean, look around again, service, terrible. Most people say it's not what it used to be. A lot of people have left the workforce because they got sick and burnt out and they went and did other things like trying to be social media influencers or buying into crypto and thinking that's going to be the future, or day trading because this market has been so frothy. But listen, all it takes is one spark and all of a sudden we've got a house of cards. Because the other thing that's going into this is the number of homes that are sitting that are being out there rented, or they're trying to rent them. Vacancies are going up. So yeah, we have a lot of homes that are maybe paid off. We have a lot of homes that might be high equity. We also have a lot of homes out there that people are sitting on trying to rent, and we are now starting to see rents go down. We're starting to see more vacancy pressure there, that they're not making revenue. And guess what, Kirk? When you own real estate, do the costs end?
Nope.
We still got taxes. You've still got maintenance. You've still got regulatory fees and things like that that you've got to pay. Costs continue, insurance, all of this stuff. So again, if you have an income, you know, and things are working really, really good, and you've got rents coming in. I'll go back to 2020. It wasn't 3 months. It wasn't even 30 days after COVID hit that a lot of Airbnb renters were complaining that they were going to go into default on their mortgage. Here we are again, and we're starting to see these vacancies going up. We're starting to see the fact that a lot of people have invested these based off of their income, and we're starting to see that last spark. Unemployment is very, very low, but we're starting to, you know, I know multiple companies now that are going through layoffs. You probably do listening too. And if all of a sudden the household balance of income changes, if they've got payments and things to deal with, that's going to start to create a spark that, again, could create where we don't necessarily have a credit issue on mortgages. We are starting to see credit issues elsewhere that could start to propagate and expand on this. I don't know if you want to add on that, Kirk.
So first of all, the chart that we're showing here, the Fed chart, is a Federal Reserve economic data. So Fred is not actually a guy. It's an acronym for Federal Reserve economic data, because otherwise Fred's doing a great job with his charts. As Doug pointed out, there's really low unemployment rate here. You know, it went up to 10, close to 15% in the last, you know, decade or so. Now it's down to 3.5, went as low as 2.5. So right now we're right around where we were prior to COVID. And that's really important. We see all these layoffs. It's still low. Let's look at this. This is kind of a chart. This is kind of historical calculations of the unemployment rate, the unemployment numbers, and then inventory of houses. The higher the unemployment rate, the higher the inventory of houses is really what they're trying to illustrate here. And there's a lot of economic data that actually is tied to the unemployment rate. So we want to talk a little bit about the housing situation. We haven't talked about it in a few weeks, and I really wanted to put some meat behind all of the thesis that we've been talking about for the last 2 years. And now we're starting to see some of the data come out, and we're able to say, here's what we've been telling you. And hopefully people have been listening, but here's what we've been telling you. So investors bought half as many homes in Q4 as they did a whole year earlier. That's really important, because that's when rates were sky high and people are just not buying because they can't afford it. Here's another one. Mortgage defaults versus foreclosure. So the foreclosure rates right now is really low. People still have jobs. We're not in a recession. They still have their houses. You know, mortgage defaults are low, although they're creeping up. But as you can see, in bad times, the crash 2008, 9, 10, the mortgage default went up to 10%. In the 2020 pandemic, it went up to 8%. Now, I don't know how they calculate 8% because courts were closed. Courts around me, they're all closed. I don't know how they did that. Maybe that was after the fact. But the point is, during crisis, it causes rates to spike, which means there's going to be a ton on the market. Right now, there's, I mean, look at this. We were at 3.5, which is as low as it's been in a few decades since the 80s for mortgage default. That's really important to recognize. That means that everything was good and everything is still apparently good. Even foreclosures are really low, even though they peaked up a little bit, but they're still really low. I'm sorry, I misread the chart. Mortgage default is high, but the foreclosure is low because of the court. So my bad, I spoke there. So as you can see, the mortgage default, but like I said, I think a lot of banks kind of shoved that under the rug, which is probably higher than that. But the point is you look at these metrics and right now everything looks great. Look at this. The numbers look great. There's no problem here. Nothing to see at all. And here's another one. I had a conversation the other day with somebody. We're talking about the conversation we have on the show, which is we talk about affordability. Is housing affordable compared to where it was? Versus what most people talk about, which is supply and demand, which is a very important metric. Not going to knock it. Supply and demand is really important. If there's no supply and demand is the same, or the supply declines and the demand's the same or goes up, now all of a sudden you got higher price and vice versa. There's a ton of supply and there's no demand, then the prices go down. That's simple economics. But looking here, I'm using this data from ReVenture, there's a few charts here. There's no housing shortage. We have the same amount of housing we've had in the last few decades. It's pretty much the same. Here's another one, home prices. We had a bubble in 2008 and 9, and where it's even a higher bubble right now. And this just shows from actually 1890, which I think is a good, I like long tail data because it just shows that we're not just living in the last 5 years, which is what most of you, what you see in the news, which is, oh, this is the highest rate hike we've ever had in recent history. What does recent history mean? Well, in the last 10 years. What about the 80s? Yeah, that's not recent enough. So, let's try to paint the picture and don't look behind the curtain and see the wizard. Here's another one. This one is one I wanted to kind of stick on.
I touched on this one a little bit, so I think I'm glad we're coming back.
Yeah, and I really want to kind of hammer this point home, which is the composition of the U.S. housing market. 97.25 million houses owned. 12 million are vacant and owned. And for sale is 662,000. So anyone who says that there's not enough homes, to me, that looks like approximately 13% of the population homes are vacant. I'm pretty sure it's not a supply and demand problem. If it was a supply and demand problem, vacant owned would be really small. For sale is small because a lot of people put it on the market and they take it off because they can't sell it or they don't want to sell it at a lower price, so they just sit on it. But vacant and owned, that's huge. 13% of the market is vacant and owned. That means there's a big margin for filling those properties. So if 10% of the population, like we saw in the earlier one, if 10% of the population is unemployed or they get kicked out of their home or for whatever reason, there's a bunch of homes that people could get into. It's not as if there aren't enough homes. It's that there are not enough homes that are affordable. And we'll raise this point over and over and over again because I talk to people every single day who say, yeah, but what about the supply and demand? There's not enough houses. Look at the chart. It looks to me like there's plenty of houses. The problem isn't there's not enough houses. There are not enough houses that are affordable. I've talked to a lot about this in the show. I'm renting right now because I don't like the prices. The prices are way too high and the affordability is crazy. And I sold last year, we got a good margin, and now I'm going to wait till things become reasonable and we'll get back in. But reasonably speaking, it's not that I can't find a home to buy. Of course I can find one, they're everywhere. What I can't find is a home that is priced within a range that is reasonable. Because if I'm accustomed to a certain home, let's say it's like $500,000 home, depending on which part of the country you're in, you could probably think that's expensive or cheap. In this part of the country, that's really cheap. But let's just say like $500,000 home is what I'm accustomed to. Let's say it's like three bedroom, three bath home. And that's the equilibrium for whatever that is. Now, let's say the yields go up and I can't afford that home anymore. Now I can't afford that $500,000 home. Now I can only afford the $400,000 home. But the $400,000 home doesn't have three bedroom, three bath. It's got two bedroom, one and a half bath. The land's less. It's not as attractive. The house has got some flaws in it. You know, it's got a stairway going to nowhere. You're like, this is not the ideal house. So it's not what I was accustomed to given my economic status. Everyone has an economic status, wherever it is, rich, poor, in the middle. And you're accustomed to certain things. And what we've been accustomed to for the last 40 years is a certain level of, when you get a starter home, it's not great. Maybe it's a condo, small house, but it's a starter home, right? You're making it work. You're figuring it out. And then you make more money, you get married, you have kids, you're like, we can't live in the starter home. We got to upsize. You spend more money, you get a bigger home. You know, the kids grow up, like, we need more house. You get a bigger home. And then everybody moves out and you're like, now we got to downsize. We downsize. So that whole process, the up and down cycle of real estate that people go through, that cycle is very similar for most people. So they go through the cycle and get bigger homes, they get smaller homes, and they go through that cycle. Everyone's kind of similar. Wherever you are in that cycle, wherever you are in the economic status, you're still going to find a place in that equilibrium. But when everything is all of a sudden twice as expensive, in order for you to fit in that equilibrium, now you're buying half of what you need or what you can afford or what you want. So now it's not as attractive to move. It's not as attractive to buy. I can't move. Now I'm miserable. Like all these things kind of pile on because sellers are not willing to part with their homes except for the high price that they have in their head. So people can't afford it. People want to sell it. Until they come to a balance, there's not going to be a sale. So there's 662,000 homes on the market. I'm sure there'd be a lot more if the vacant owned, if they could sell it, they probably would. So the thing to just keep in mind is that this balance is the linchpin of this equation. So this one thing, you know, we talk about in the show occasionally, like you try to figure out what's the one lever that moves everything else. Like what's the lever that moves the world? And the one lever for the Federal Reserve is basically interest rates. What are we going to do if interest rates are high and we go into recession? That's the one lever. If you tell me the answer to that, I will tell you everything else is going to happen in the next 10 years. But until you figure out that answer, everything else is a question mark. In this case, the lever of the housing market is affordability. It's not supply and demand. Supply and demand is always an impact, but it's supply and demand that is based on affordability. So until you get to a place where you have an equilibrium in affordability, you're not going to get a cohesive housing market in any way, shape, or form that you're going to want to buy a house. You don't want to buy a house right now. This is the worst thing you can do. And you're going to lose lots of money and housing will probably go down. If interest rates come down, that's the other side. So housing prices don't have to drop. Interest rates could decline to zero. And then all of a sudden, housing is back in equilibrium. But until that equilibrium happens, either rates come down a lot, they have to come down to like 3% mortgages. Until they come down or house prices come down, we're in an impasse. We're not making a deal. Oh, you want to sell your thing for $10,000 and I want to buy it for a dollar? We're at an impasse. We're not making a deal. And until that happens, the housing market is going to be all over the place.
This will not be a short-term problem. This is a longer-term problem. But part of that 10, 12 million homes that are vacant and unoccupied, some of that is second homes. There are people that have invested for themselves. It's their cabin. They have no interest in necessarily trying to rent it out or getting rid of it economically. It's something that they've done for personal use. The challenge I think is going to happen here is generationally. One of the largest populations ever is the baby boomers. And they also have a large majority of the wealth. Wealthiest of all time, really, if you calculate them as a generation. What's happening is we're going to get to a point where they're aging. And yeah, they might have their house paid off, or they might have their house at a very low interest rate. If they have their house paid off, the question comes down to, will the next generation, which is likely going to be Gen X, one of the smallest generations ever, will they want that house for the brick and mortar? Do they live there? Do they want to move into it? The reality is how many people want to move into their parents' house? There is a select number of population that do, but there's a huge population that does not. They're already established. They already have their own home. So do they keep the cabin and their parents' home and their home? More than likely, if they've moved out of state or in their different places, they're going to want to look at how do I get the liquidity out of this? And you know, they might want to keep it as an investment, but we're already seeing a problem with homes being able to be rented under the current cycle. So who knows what's going to happen there? But you know, as baby boomers start to pass away, there is going to become an availability of homes. If those homes that the baby boomers are living in still have a mortgage and have a low interest rate, here's the reality. Banks won't let the next generation keep that mortgage. They must transition that mortgage into the beneficiary's name, at which time it becomes a refinance. So this is not like you can keep a 2.5% mortgage into perpetuity. Again, this isn't going to happen tomorrow, but as this transition of wealth happens over the next 10 to 15 years, there is going to potentially be an influx of supply just because it's forced onto the marketplace because the primary homeowner is no longer alive. And I don't think we're talking about that enough.
No, we're not. I think we talked about it on an earlier episode on how the baby boomers basically have to come back. And instead of going to retire to Florida and living it up with their big nest egg, is they're going to have to come back and support the kids. And what's interesting is the baby boomers have effectively caused the biggest wealth creation in our country's history. And they're also, if they're going to be selfish about it, they're also going to cause probably the biggest amount of wealth destruction. What they've basically done is inadvertently, I'm not saying the baby boomers deliberately did this or intentionally, just saying by nature of demographics and the populations, what they've basically done is leech the system. They've created this enormous problem in the system that is basically stealing from future generations to pay for today. And like I said, they didn't do it deliberately, but it's by the nature of the fact that they're the biggest segment of the population. And, you know, they're the me generation. And the fact that they're still even in politics and power just as scary.
my generation, Gen X, and yours, Doug, like, we should be taken over in politics. And what's fascinating is you've got millennials in there and you've got boomers in there. The extras are like, I don't want any part of this. You guys are terrible. I don't want to be a part of this system. And so our generation isn't even in power. So there's this huge generational problem and shift. But the point is, you know, the people in power, they do things based on their perspective. And their perspective is such that baby boomers had this environment where they're looking at, oh, we want a good experience. It's all about me. I want to do this. I want to do that. And the extras are like, leave me alone. Just leave me alone. Let me do my thing. You know, you walk into a store and it's like, oh, can I help you? No. Just looking. Leave me alone.
If I need your help, I'll ask. Don't smother me.
Exactly. Like, we're latchkey kids, right? We had to figure it out ourselves. Right. And now you got the millennials. They're pretty much, you know, they had helicopter parents and all that stuff. And the millennials are similar to the boomers. But the point being is each culture, each segment of the population has its own cultural shift. And that dictates societally where we go. Right. And it's usually the most influential part is the one that dictates the direction. Right now it's millennials, and next it could be Gen Z or whatever, but each one kind of has their own influence. The younger generation provides a lot of influence. It used to be through music. Now it's less so, but it's still a little bit through music. But anyway, the point being is these cultural shifts are important. Now, if you look at this chart, another chart by Mr. Fred, the total net worth held by the top 1% in comparison to the total net worth held by the bottom 50%. You have to see this visually. You can go on our website, you'll see it. You can go on our recorded session on YouTube and see it there. It is ridiculous, the size of difference of the net worth by the top. I mean, to give you some numbers, just to put it into perspective, and it's hard to see the numbers from this chart, but the top 1% total net worth on average is somewhere in the neighborhood of $45 million. And then the net worth on average of the bottom 50% is, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I think this is in millions of dollars. So technically this is aggregate. So this is the aggregation of the total net worth.
Billion.
Yeah. So basically taking all the top 1% and adding them together, the total net worth is 45 million million. So whatever that is, like 45 trillion or quadrillion.
Yep, 45 trillion.
Yeah, so $45 trillion, the top 1%. The bottom 50% aggregate is somewhere in the neighborhood of three million million. So
75 trillion to 3 trillion.
You have approximately 10x or whatever that is, like 12x difference. The point I'm making here is it's not necessarily the numbers, because you can look at that and say those numbers are so big they don't make any sense to me, which is the problem when we look at statistics, big statistics. Who was it? One of Hitler's guys, Goebbels or something, who said like a single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Or maybe it was Lenin. It was one of those guys.
It sounds like something I think came from the Soviet Revolution.
I think it was.
But either way, it was from people that you probably don't want to emulate.
Yes, you don't want to emulate them. By a long shot. If you're thinking about emulating, please go jump in a lake. But if you understand like the big numbers, people don't understand the big numbers because they're too big. In this case, you'd have to see it visually, because it's not the fact that there's a big spread. If you look back in 1990, the difference was somewhere in the neighborhood of like 1 million million and 5 million million. So there's a much smaller spread of the difference. So enormous amounts of wealth were created in 2009. Enormous amounts of wealth were created from 90 to 2000. And you really have to see this. The bottom 50% did not partake.
They doubled during the entire period compared to what X did the top number go up?
It's really nuts. It just shows the severity of the problems that we have. And you could argue whether it's good or bad, but I've looked at the historical charts and people say, well, the wealthy are taking too much. The wealthy are evil. The wealthy are bad. It's not the wealthy. And I want to use this framework to illustrate, and then we're going to wrap it up. I just realized we've kind of run out of time here. There's an important framework. We're going into a time where there's huge, and there will be, huge economic unrest over the next probably 15 years, based on a lot of the demographic shifts, based on a lot of the pensions, Social Security and Medicare running out of money, all of that. The next 15 years, there's going to be enormous economic shifts in many different ways. And if you look at these times historically, during these times, what tends to happen is people without tend to attack people with. So if you have money and people without see that you have money, they're not going to like it. And if they're really in dire straits, they're going to come after you one way, shape, or form, whether socially, physically, economically. There'll be some shape or form. There's a reason why
the top Goldman Sachs executives have bodyguards and they have compounds and protection because they see it too. Historically, this is what happens. People come after the wealthy because they feel like the wealthy are taking advantage of them.
You look at the French Revolution, you look at Cuba, you look at the Russian czars. Almost every situation where there has been an astronomical increase of disparity between the top and the bottom, it has led to some sort of a severe instability geopolitically. But you look at the Arab Spring, it's almost always tied to food famine and its difference of need. We're already starting to see it here, and I'm not trying to get the tinfoil out, but if you look since COVID, you look and go into cities like where I'm at in Minneapolis, carjackings, brazen, broad daylight, in places you would have never seen it before. We had a lady in downtown Stillwater, Minnesota, which is a river town, very, you'd think, safe, not where you'd expect crime. She worked for the church. She was walking to her car and got carjacked in Stillwater. We're seeing catalytic converters being stolen off. We're seeing an increase in violent, unprovoked, non-domestic crime, meaning the perp does not know the victim. I mean, it's happening. And I don't know if it's tied directly to this, but again, going back to the beginning of our conversation, look around, be aware. If something sounds like it's a little bit different and seems different than normal, just recognize it and understand the variables that are in play.
You can make the argument. I've heard some people make this argument, and I haven't fully thought it through, but I tend to agree with it, which is virtually all of our problems in this country stem from economics. You can take any problem, and it will stem from economics. You say, well, what about education? What about this? Economics. It always comes down to economics. And so when you have...
We see it in the college planning space. Who's getting into these schools? Where are the U.S. News and World Reports pushes people into thinking these rankings and paying more and creating a system that is built only for the affluent of education. Right. And one last thing to go into that note economically is it also continues to be a problem because you look at the bottom 50% going from one and a half trillion or whatever number to 3 trillion. That's a doubling over 30 years. Whereas you look at the top wealth went from 5 or 7 trillion up to 75. So they went up 10 times. And you look at that comparison, well, that also goes into now who inherits it. What does that do in terms of the control of politics? What does it do to control of who's getting the money next? Once it gets concentrated, it rarely gets spread out again, which is where this cycle has a very difficult time unraveling itself.
When you wrap it up, I'll finish my thought. We got to tie it in here.
Since I talked about the college thing, let's just talk about that. Listen, it is getting harder. And obviously, as I mentioned, the rankings lists are manipulative. If anybody has seen Operation Varsity Blues on Netflix, go watch it. There's been a problem with college planning people. I've got a family this last week who basically said, I want to go to this one school. They can't afford it. It doesn't fit. But yet they were emotionally invested in it to where this school could cost them $200,000. And the school basically pushed the kid to Spring. He basically told him, we don't think you're a great fit here either. But they truly believed as a family, we got to go to this elite, prestigious school to be successful. And it's going to cost them generational wealth. Now, another example of a family where a person just graduated with 2 majors, 2 minors, and varsity in sports, some school you've never heard of in Louisiana. And guess what? Every medical school in the country is coming after that person. Even though she didn't go to a big name school, she did it right. So if you want to do it right and pay less money to have a greater outcome and get that return on investment, no matter what your wealth and status is, understand a process. Go to procollegeplanners.com. That's our company. We have a 9-step checklist. You can learn about the numbers there. We have a checklist and a process we follow. If you want to do it right, save money and have an extraordinary outcome. Learn more at procollegeplanners.com.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Doug. Yeah, so just to finish my point, the point I'm making is that the economic disparities that we're having are going to continue, and you need to understand how those are going to impact all of these factors. And the big shifts happen slowly, but they do happen and they're powerful, and you can't fight those big shifts. It's like Japan with their demographics. They have a population that is shrinking. I think like 15 years ago, they sold more adult diapers than baby diapers, as an example. China's got the same problem. Most countries in the world have this problem. Those countries have problems mostly because of the policy they had, the China's one-child policy. There's lots of countries that have this, and everyone's fighting for new people. So demographic shifts make a huge difference in the direction of economics. But just understand and prepare, right? That's what we're trying to help you do. We're trying to help you prepare.
to put you in the best financial situation you can possibly have. So that's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast at moneytreepodcast.com. And when you're on our website, you'll have access to the show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Also, we're now on YouTube, so please check out our YouTube channel. When you're there, please subscribe and leave a comment. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Oh, and don't forget, do your own research. This show is for informational use only. We're not telling you what to think, merely how to think about investing. We're also not selling you any products or services, so do not consider this advice. If you have any problems with the show, I blame Putin. So please send him an email and express your feelings. If you're seeking financial advice, talk to an oracle or a fortune teller or maybe just a licensed financial advisor. I'm one, but as I said earlier, I'm not selling anything, but I'm easy to find. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.